give me some time to receive the message of being free.
Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Lindsay, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This is a reading based on the passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our own personal stories describe in their own language, from their own point of view, the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker and will believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them. I must have this thing. Now I'm going to introduce our speaker. I met this lovely lady the other day at a step study workshop. I couldn't think of the word, sorry. Her name is Shan, and she is a member of the Fifth Tradition Group, and I'm very excited to hear what she has to share with us. Hi, everybody. I'm Shan. I'm an alcoholic. And it's great to be here tonight with you. My sobriety date is April 24th, 2012. And I have a sponsor, and I sponsor other women. I'm very grateful alcoholic. Glad to be here tonight. Okay, so what it was like. Okay, so I grew up in Tishon, Georgia. I'm a Georgia girl. And I was the youngest of a family of five children. And I remember when I was very young, I had a lot of fear. And I still have fear, but now I pray for God to remove it. So I didn't have contact with God back then. But I was a fearful little girl, and I was very self-willed even back then. I remember if I didn't get my way, I would, I know children throw tantrums, but mine were pretty bad. And my mom would, I think she didn't know how to handle me. I don't really think she did. But I always liked being the center of attention, and I liked to be in a group of people. It just kind of got me going. I'm pretty much by nature, I'm a shy person and don't talk a lot. But if I get around people, then I kind of open up and blossom. So I always thought I was an introvert, but I'm really an extrovert. But back then, I liked going to parties. So I partied a lot in my high school days. My first drink was, I think I was 13 or 14. My mom liked it better if we stayed home when we did things like that. So it was at my home. And my brother gave me my first drink, and I took the drink. You hear people talk about this, but it's really true. When I took that first drink, I got kind of giggly, and I felt like I was part of something, because I used to think that I didn't feel like a part of something because I was the youngest and all my brothers and sisters were so much older, but I really think it was my alcoholism. Maybe a little bit that I was the youngest, but, I never felt like I fit in. I felt left out, and that made me feel like I fit in because they were, everyone was, kind of like, well, she's having a good time, So I kind of, took that and ran with it. Well, I didn't drink a lot, in the years after that. But when I hit high school, I did. At first it was just, a few beers, a couple of days, and then it got worse. I remember drinking beer until, I never really drank just one. It was always more.
I would drink until I was just, you know, giggly, and then later I would drink until I was unconscious. So I started drinking until I blacked out in high school. Plus, back then, I mean, drugs are part of my story. Back then, you know, I grew up in the 60s, 70s, so in Tifton, I guess my excuse was there's not a lot to do here, so I'm just going to party, you know. You know, it's kind of boring. So I just partied. And I smoked marijuana, but it was always with a drink. It was always a beer or liquor or something. And I got in the habit of, you know, I would get, you know, to the point where I was really relaxed and, you know, to the point of passing out. And then I would take something so that I could wake up a little bit, so that I could be more social. Because I always had trouble being social. I felt like, you know, I don't know how to talk to people. I didn't get the user's manual on how to, you know, do life and how to be around people and have a good time. So I thought that just really, you know, really helped me. So, I had a best friend in the 10th grade. We were lab partners, and she would come over on the weekends, and we would just, you know, do LSD and get drunk. That's what we did. You know, it's like, you know, instead of going to the rec center, we would just, you know, go to my house and do LSD. I mean, you know, it was, I never had a bad trip. It was nice. But, you know, I really enjoyed it. But after a while, you know, it got to the point where it was just too much. I remember, I think it was the 11th grade, and I remember for my prom that I was just, you know, too drunk to even know what I was doing. And when I saw the picture they took of me and my date, it was awful. You know, like my eyes were half open, and I don't know, it was awful. But I just kind of, you know, I thought I needed drugs, and like I would come to school and do speed or something, because I thought that made me smarter, you know, and that I could answer questions in class. And I thought that I didn't think anybody knew what I was doing. I really didn't, you know, but I'm sure it was obvious that I was messed up. But I don't think nobody said anything. But let's see. So it got worse. I got to the point where I couldn't function very well when I went to school. And I dropped out of high school in the 11th grade. Moved in with my boyfriend who sold pot, so that wasn't a very good life choice. But I stayed with him for a while. He was abusive to me, so I eventually got out of that relationship, and I got my GED, and my mouth is really dry. Then I thought I would try to go to college, because I mean, I was always, like, wanting to do better, you know, but I just don't think I knew how. So I went to the community college in Tifton, and but there again, you know, I was with the wrong crowd. I was, you know, drinking and doing drugs. And it was always about what people thought of me, and I thought that they thought better of me when I was more lively and vibrant, thinking this. Anyway, I didn't finish college. I ended up, I was living at home, and my mother really didn't know what to do with me, so she sent me to live with my sister in Atlanta. And I continued to do drugs and drink. It got to the point where, you know, I didn't ever really drink every day, maybe a couple of beers, and then on the weekend I would drink liquor because that got me drunk faster, and you know, just get into a lot of trouble on the weekends. But I was always able to go to work, go to my job. I got a job in Atlanta. And I was always able to kind of to function. And I went to school. I went to technical school, printing school, and finished that and got a job. But I was still, you know, still all that time drinking, drinking every day. But I would tell myself, you know, you're not getting up in the morning and drinking. You're able to function, so you're okay. You know, it'll get better. That was always what I thought. I thought, you know, one of these days I'll just, you know, I'll get better. I'll straighten up. It'll get better. But it really didn't. So I lived that life for several years, and I ended up, I shared an apartment with two other women, and we were all the same. I mean, we all drank and partied. But one of my roommates went to an AA meeting, and she left literature sitting around the apartment, and I looked at the literature, and, you know, and she said, well, AA is a room full of love, and that attracted me, so I went to an AA meeting with her, and saw the steps on the wall and thought that it was kind of strange. I didn't see, you know, how that was going to help me. But I took a white chip, and this was in 1987. So I stayed in AA for about 5 years, went to meetings. I had a sponsor who did encourage me to do service work. So I was on the steering committee. I was a GSR, went to Macon. However, I really didn't take the first step totally. I did not admit to myself that I'm an alcoholic. I was just kind of, you know, skirting along on the outskirts, really. Even though I did service, I wasn't really totally committed to my recovery. I didn't put it first. I kind of used it as a social club or a dating service, you know, things like that, unfortunately. So I finally, I was still pretty depressed. I've had depression all my life. I forgot to mention that when I was a child, I had sexual abuse from a man that lived next door to my grandparents. And I'm saying that not because that's what made me an alcoholic, but it kind of figures into my story. Because I had feelings of shame and had a lot of anger and self-pity. I didn't know that's what it was at the time. I thought it was because I was abused, and I just thought, well, you know, if I heal these emotions, I'll be okay. And that's when I started going into the self-help and getting self-help books, learning about my inner child and trying to heal my inner child and going to COA meetings and things like that. Because I just figured, well, you know, this is going to help my depression and, you know, then I'll be okay. But at that time, after I left AA, I wasn't drinking, but I wasn't really in recovery either. I wasn't recovered because I didn't take the first step. But I was very miserable and very depressed, and my life is just, you know, going downhill. So I tried a lot of things. I mean, I tried going to church. I took the meditation class, and I did affirmations. I just tried a lot of things, you know, to come out of that. But it didn't really work for me. Several years went by, and I was, you know, starting to really get worse and worse. And it was starting to be so I couldn't get a job very easily. And I had bought a condo, and I was starting not to be able to get jobs. And I worked as a nanny for a few years, and then I decided I'd rather work with elderly people. So I finally got a job doing that. But at the time, I was really, my health was getting bad. I wasn't taking very good care of myself, and I just really thought I was having trouble walking because my hips were bad. But I just thought, well, they'll get better on their own, which they didn't. But, you know, it's like I was going to see these alternative healers, and they'd say, well, you know, let me do some energy healing, and it'll get better. And and I thought that would work. So anyway, so I think I'm probably talking too fast, but finally, it was around 2010, and I had got to the point where I could, you know, barely walk, and I got a job as a elder care provider. A man's son hired me to take care of him, and I did that job for about a year and a half. But meanwhile, I was losing friends and didn't have much of a life. Usually, I would just sit home and watch TV because I love to be home by myself, and I still do. But I don't do it as much as I used to because I can't stay sober that way. But I would just stay home and watch TV and then go to my job. And, you know, that was just life to me. That was, you know, my excitement was, you know, watching a comedy show late night or something, you know, late at night. That was my excitement. So that was my life then. But I got that job and had that job for about a year and a half. Now, I wasn't doing any drugs or alcohol because after I left AA, I still didn't do any of that because I think for one reason, I mean, I had enough AA that I didn't do it. And also, I hung out with people who were in other 12-step groups and also people who were in recovery from sexual abuse. So I hung out with those people, and they didn't drink or do drugs. So I don't know. You know, I know God was in my life. You know, he was always there. I just didn't have conscious contact with him. But, you know, he didn't just suddenly appear after I got conscious contact. He was in my life. I think he was watching over me. So I didn't drink or do any drugs. But meanwhile, I was taking care of that man, and he was diagnosed with lung cancer. He was my patient. I was very close to him. And then after about a year and a half, he started to go downhill. And I remember very clearly one night I was feeling very, very anxious and worried because he was, you know, hospice had already come out and they were just, you know, taking care of him until he passed away. So they had brought a big box of drugs and put it in the refrigerator. And there's all kinds of drugs in there. So I remember that night thinking how anxious and bad I felt, and I just didn't want to feel that way anymore. So I thought, well, what if I take a drug? And, you know, that alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful, and also the disease is progressive. So I did not have any defense at all. So I reached in the box of drugs, and I took a Xanax. And, you know, it took care of my anxiety for that time, but it took care of it. But he did pass away. He passed away not long after that, and I didn't have any money saved up. I didn't have a job after that. I was very bad with money. I didn't know how to prioritize money or, you know, prioritize my bills. I don't know how to save money. I was just kind of getting along on, you know, my own self-will and trying to figure it out, which is what I did most of the time. So I didn't have much money, and I started, like, charging stuff on my charge card and not being able to pay it back. And just through all this time, though, I still thought that I could manage my life. That was the theme, you know, all my life. I thought, well, I can do this, you know. I'm smart enough then I can manage my life. I've got enough, you know, got enough guts, you know, I can do this. So, so it was going to take a lot, really, to smash that ego. So, after I lost that job, I was just kind of hanging out at home, and I had some dental work done, and I took those drugs also, not for the pain, but, you know, to feel better. I took drugs another couple of times. And the weeks went by, and I started feeling, at first I thought, well, I'm probably grieving over this man, you know, and that was probably true, you know, but I was crying every day. I felt like that I just, you know, I felt like I couldn't get myself together, and I just wake up and cry every day, and I had nowhere to go. And it started to feel like I was falling apart, like a bomb had got off inside me or something. I felt like I'm falling apart, and I don't know what's happening, and I was very scared. But I went to an Al-Anon meeting. I was still trying to fix myself. I went to an Al-Anon meeting because I thought, well, that will help, won't it? That will help with these feelings, you know. I just have to detach from that man that died, so that's what I did. I went to Al-Anon meetings a few times, and it did help, because Al-Anon meetings, you know, God is there, so. But I remember one night that there was a woman there, and she was alcoholic and Al-Anon, and she looked at me, and she said, "You're about to go out and take a drink." And I didn't believe her that night. You know, I was like, I don't know what she's talking about. But I guess I look pretty pathetic. So a few more times of going to Al-Anon meetings, and eventually I started to feel like, in Bill's story, he talks about that quicksand is all around, and about the despair and the four horsemen. You know, I started to feel that. And it really felt like that I was sinking into quicksand, and that, you know, my little hand was just barely, you know, peeking out. And eventually, I mean, it was only a matter of maybe a month or so, but I went to an AA meeting. There was one down the street from me. I knew where it was. I had gone to it a few months before, thinking, well, you know, I can really show these people something, you know. That's my ego. So I went to that meeting and sat down and cried, and I cried through the whole meeting, especially at the Lord's Prayer. And I think that for me, I just knew that I had lost my contact with God. I'd lost my spirituality. It was gone. And I was just, you know, I was really very despairing and despondent. And a woman gave me her phone number. I took a white chip. And she became my first sponsor after I came back. And that was on a Friday night that happened. So she invited me to a meeting at Peachford Hospital that her then fiance was giving. So I went to that meeting, and I met someone there who told me about a group called the Fifth Tradition Group. And he invited me to a meeting of the Fifth Tradition Group. So I actually thought he was cute, so I went to the meeting. I loved the meeting. There was a lot of energy there. So I kept going to those meetings, and I also went to the meeting where my sponsor was. And I did work the steps with that sponsor. I got another sponsor after her because she couldn't sponsor me because she said she had to get her nursing certificate. And she said, I can't give you enough attention. And I was really grateful that she was honest with me. So I got another sponsor at the Peachtree Corners Group. And we went through the 12 and 12, the steps in the 12 and 12. And I love the 12 and 12, and I think it works great for some people, but it really didn't work for me. to the extent where I could have stayed sober, because for me, I have to really work hard on my sobriety. I have to do everything. And I needed the big book. I needed, you know, to go through the program of recovery in the big book. I got another sponsor at the fifth edition group. I have to say that the sponsor I had gave me a lot, and I'm very grateful for what she gave me, and I told her that. But I wanted a sponsor in the fifth edition group because I was going to change to that group, and I felt like my sponsor should be in the same group as I was back then. So I did, you know. I went through the big book with my sponsor, and she was a great sponsor. And I started to see things I hadn't seen before. It just became very, very clear to me that I am an alcoholic and that I can't take a drug or a drink without taking so many that I can't control it. I always tried to control my drinking. I didn't ever really want to stop. I just wanted to control it. I wanted to control it to the point that I could be conscious and talking, you know, but not, you know, pass out. But I never was very good at that. So the sponsor took me through the big book, and I started to see. I remember when I first came to AA, and people would say to me things like, you know, there'll come a time when you won't have any defense against the first drink. And I remember thinking, well, then why are we coming to these meetings? I didn't understand it, but I understood it when I came back. It was like, you know, cotton was pulled out of my ears or something. I listened to every word, and I just soaked it up, because I was really desperate. I was at the point of desperation, because I knew, you know, down to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic, and that if I take another drink or drug, I may not make it back to AA, and I know that today. I went through those steps and with that sponsor, and she was sponsored by another woman, and she, unfortunately, by the time we got to my fifth step, she had relapsed, and she was a great sponsor. I really was surprised, but that's what happened. So I remember that night I went to the meeting at Fifth Tradition, and a lot of people were standing around talking, and I was like, what are they talking about? So the next day, the woman that's my sponsor now called me and said, I want to tell you before you find out for someone else that your sponsor relapsed. And she said, I'm sorry, I'm going to cry. okay, sorry. She said, just, you know, take a minute, take a while and get another sponsor, but don't wait too long. So I did. You know, I took a few days, and then I thought, well, that was so nice of her to call me and say that. And I see her at every meeting. Excuse me. I see her at every meeting, and she's reached her hand out to the newcomer, and I think that she would be a great sponsor. So I asked her to sponsor me, and she's my sponsor today. And I finished my fifth step with her, and thank you. and I just cry because I'm grateful. I finished my fifth step with her, and the way we did it really spoke to me, because when we were looking at my fourth step, she just said, you know, I wrote down all the people I was angry at and felt like a victim, you know, about, because that was in a lot of my inventory. I felt like a victim. I'll just touch on this because, you know, I kind of used my abuse as kind of a cover, like, you know, well, I feel like a victim, but it's just because I was abused, you know. But it wasn't. It's because I'm an alcoholic, and I wasn't feeling empowered. I was feeling like a victim. So anyway, when she Like, for instance, I would say, well, I'm angry at my mother, and she'd say, well, cover up that person, your mother, and what kind of daughter are you? And that really floored me. I was like, oh. So, you know, I had to admit I wasn't a very good daughter, and I was self-centered, and I wasn't there for my mother when she needed me. And that just started the whole change for me, because, you know, I'm a self-centered alcoholic, and I finally saw it. I really didn't ever think I was self-centered because I thought, well, I'm a sweet person, you know, and I am a sweet person. But I'm also self-centered, and also, you know, I want my way, things like that. But then I saw it, you know, I thought, yeah, that's self-centered. You know, I didn't even think about my mom's feelings. So we went through the whole fourth step and the fifth step, and by the end of it, I felt very much changed. I felt like these resentments, I had resentments about people at the group, and they started just melting away. I remember one night I was sitting at the dinner table with this man I had a resentment against, and he said something. Yeah, we had all gone out for dinner after the meeting, and he said something, and I just said, well, I'm so glad you're part of this group, you know, or something like that. I'm like, wow. You know, I never thought those words would come out of my mouth to that man, because I really was mad at him. But, you know, I mean, I was starting to change. I was starting to see my part, and that I don't have to live my life in resentment and self-pity. That was about 10 years ago. And since then, I mean, my life today, what it's like today is wonderful, because I have deep friendships with people that I never thought I would have. I didn't know I was capable of. I didn't know I could love people that much. And that I had that much love to give. I mean, I think I always love people, but there's just too much of me wanting my own way, or, you know, selfishness for me to really be a very good friend. But I've learned how to be a good friend and to give. And that's just priceless for me. And it's so different. I remember, I made my amends to my sisters and to my mother. I had to write her a letter because she'd passed away. But, you know, I made all my amends, and I remember just feeling like that, you know, I'd totally changed. And my sister did say that to me. She said, you're different as night and day. She said, you're just really different. And I'm like, I'm sure that's a good thing. but, you know, I mean, I've been able to be there for my family, and in a way that I never was before, and that's priceless to me. And I've been able to sponsor other women who, I mean, I really love it. I love sponsoring other women. It really makes me work my program. I mean, it really, you know, sometimes I get aggravated if they're not doing what I think they should do. But, you know, I have to just let go of that and ask God to remove it and then take some action. But it really keeps me sober, and it changes me, and it makes me grow. And, you know, in a way I never did, and I love that. And, you know, I feel like I have a family in AA, and I love coming here and seeing all your faces. I really do. I love AA. I owe AA my life. And I love to do service, you know. Sometimes, you know, I still just want to stay home and hide under the covers, but but I know I can't do that, and besides, my sponsor won't let me, so. but that's the kind of sponsor I need. I now have a great job. It's a part-time job, but I'm still helping seniors, and I'm working for myself. And I make a good living. And financially, I really through. I know my brother-in-law told me the other night, he said, you've really gotten more fiscally responsible. And yet, yeah, I have. So now I pay my bills. I have the money to pay him, you know. When I started making my amends, I was scared because I thought, I don't have much money. You know, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this. But then, I'm supposed to be trusting God, right? So I did. And I paid my homeowner association. I owed them, I paid them for $100 like a month for a couple of years and paid that off. And, I'm on time with all my other bills, and it's getting late. But I also wanted to touch on that, how God showed up for me, because when I came back to AA, I really could barely walk. I mean, I had no mobility in my hips. I had just passed the point when I should have gotten operations, way past the point. And I remember, at one point, I think it was my second year sober, that my condo was in foreclosure. I needed hip replacements, and my job was about to end. And I was just like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? But I just reached out, talked to my sponsor and my network and prayed about it. And I went to Legal Aid, and I got into this program called Home Safe Georgia that helps people get current with their loans. So I got current with my loan. I didn't lose my condo. I was able to get unemployment after my job ended when I wasn't supposed to, but I was told just to apply to the Department of Labor and see what happens. Don't close your mind, be open. So I did, and I got unemployment. And as a result of that, I was out of work long enough that I could get disability. And then I got disability in 2 weeks, and people were amazed. They were. It's because my hips were so bad, they were really bad. But I was able to get my hip replacements. I kept my home. And then I was like, I got a job, I was like very happy with that. And I just want to touch on that because that's God. If you start recovering and you put your recovery first, and do the things you're supposed to do, God's going to show up. And all those obstacles are, they're just gone. But you got to reach out for help. You got to, do what your sponsor says. You got to do service work. Go to your meetings. Even when you want to stay home and watch TV, that's what you got to do. That's what I have to do. So very happy with my life. I recently had a death in the family, and I'm getting through that, and I'm able to be there for the rest of my family and show up, and to me, that's everything. I mean, that is everything, and I'm sorry, but my message is just gratitude. I'm an older lady. I'm supposed to be like staying at home and in the rocking chair, but I have some great friends. I go out and do fun things, and I love going to AA meetings. So I think that's all I have for tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Shan. I've asked Deirdre to hand out the chips.
Hello, I'm Deirdre, and I'm an alcoholic. Here at the Blue Chip Speaker Meeting, we have a chip system to denote the time in your sober time. We offer the white chip for just coming back in or your first time. All right, we have a silver chip for 30 days. Thank you. a just goldish color chip for 60 days. And we got a red chip for 90 days. We have a yellow chip for 6 months. You were on a roll. We got a green chip for 9 months. And a blue chip for years or multiples. My name is P. Krishna, and congratulations to everybody else for that chip. There's a lot of sobriety in here. And I have to start off by thanking my higher power. I didn't realize coming back to AA, it took me, I guess this is year 9, to get this this 1 year. Because I grew up like super religious, and I had completely, you know, stopped going to church and all of that stuff. And because this was not a religious program, it was a, you know, a spiritual program, that concept of a higher power, it really led me back to, you know, restoring my relationship with the God of my understanding, who is, you know, Jesus Christ. And that is really my superpower, is my relationship. I have a lot of darkness in my story, and even through my sobriety. And it seemed like there's still kind of a dark cloud that's still kind of like lingering over me, but the difference is I know that my higher power is with me. So I feel like I can go through any storm. I've gotten bigger than my storms because I know that I have my higher power with me at all times. And for the speaker, I just wanted to thank you for sharing your experience, strength, and hope, because it's not perfect. You know, I still have to work on my relationships. Like, I don't have any friends, but I've cleared the train wreckage or whatever in my past. So, you know, it gives me hope when I hear someone else who used to be where I'm at, and now she says she has friends. So that gives me hope. So I wanted to thank you for that. And also my area of finances and, you know, career, work, and things like that, which she also said, you know, it used to be bad for her, but it's better now. So I just want to thank all of you ladies who are the trailblazers for women like me.
Of being free. Give me some time to breathe. It's not that I don't want to see. I misunderstood your words to go ahead. Forget my world. Oh, and I surrender. And even darkness could be a light. Oh.